thrilled that we can Health Law, the podcast of record for the discussion of health law and policy. We're recording this episode on August 19th, 2015. I'm Nicholas Terry, a law professor at Indiana University McKinney School of Law in Indianapolis. My co-host, Frank Pasquale, is on assignment in Brooklyn. Today, a rather special twill. Rather than me being mediated by the dreaded Skype, a few of us are all in the same room, and I'm delighted to be joined by Barbara Evans. Barbara is professor of law and George Butler Research Professor and the director of the Center on Biotechnology and the Law, as well as being an affiliated faculty in Energy, Environment, and Natural Resources and affiliated member of the Baylor College of Medicine Center for Medical Ethics and Health Policy. Welcome, Barbara.
Hello, thank you.
And also joined here by Eric Meslin, whose list of accomplishments is as long, Associate Dean for Bioethics in the Indiana University School of Medicine and the founding director of the Indiana University Center for Bioethics, and perhaps his greatest ever achievement, Professor of Law and Bioethics here at IU McKinney School of Law. Welcome, Eric.
Nice to be here, Nick.
Twill prides itself on confronting knotty problems. Both of you, from slightly different perspectives, work right in the middle of several legal and ethical maelstroms. So I think we have an almost unlimited range of things we could explore in the short time we have together. But Barbara, let's start with you, and let's talk a little bit about the FDA and some of its sort of regulatory fellow travelers. What's your 500-foot sense of the agency and its powers, particularly with a sort of a frame of the ever-changing science and technology, external policy forces? I mean, we all know that this 21st Century Cures Act, which I call the deregulation bill, is coming towards us at some point. And then, of course, we've got this steady march of the First Amendment. The FDA was set up to regulate consumable products in a very traditional healthcare environment. But you now paint a picture, I think, that's more about a data-driven world, and I wondered how you see those pieces fit together.
The Food and Drug Administration, of course, plays a very important role, and it's a very trusted regulatory agency, and its traditional mandate has been to regulate medical products. And one of the complexities it's facing now is that a lot of the really important medical products of our time are basically things that generate information, things like a genetic test or a diagnostic. And these are a crucial basis that guides the decisions we make about our health care. So if they're wrong, that can be very unsafe for us. But the concept of product safety is different. The usual concept of an unsafe product would be something like a hip implant where the device itself injures you. Well, no one gets hurt by a genetic testing machine. I guess they could if it exploded and threw shrapnel through the doctor's office, but that's not the safety problem we think about. The one that concerns us is that the tests may be ineffective. They may tell us we have a gene variant we don't have, or it may be misinterpreted that they think it's a gene variant that could predispose us to disease, but that's not so. So the harms aren't direct by the device that FDA is regulating. It's the lack of safety comes from wrong information. That runs up against First Amendment issues because it's concerning when a government agency is asked to tell you that information is dangerous, and there are boundaries on how it can do that.
So I think we've seen just recently, of course, there was the, I think we talked about this on a recent show, the Glocks and Docs case from Florida about doctors being essentially prohibited from having in-depth discussions with patients about gun ownership and so on. And we've seen a series of cases involving regulatory agencies, unapproved uses of drugs and so on, that certainly suggest that the First Amendment is marching fast in our direction. And then, of course, in this last term, we had the goofy signs case, but Justice Thomas's opinion really suggested quite a radical new way of looking at the First Amendment and really imperiling some of our regulatory approaches.
Mm-hmm. And the First Amendment is, of course, familiar to all of us, but it has a lot of nuances. And one exception to the First Amendment is called the professional speech doctrine. A lawyer in a client relationship with a client or a physician talking to a patient in a treatment encounter can be regulated, and that regulation is usually by the state licensing board. And that's one of the areas where speech can be regulated, but it's very contextual. There was an interesting case in Connecticut one time of a dentist who was making wild statements about the risks of silver amalgam fillings in treating patients, and that it would, he could be regulated and sanctioned for that. But then he wrote a newspaper editorial saying the same thing, and they couldn't punish him for that. So,
right, and I think he was on 60 Minutes as well, as I remember the case.
The Briner case.
Yes.
And one of the difficulties is that in our evolving healthcare system, we have individuals who are playing multiple roles. You know, the person who's your physician may also be an inventor of a genetic test and may also be a scholar who goes out to academic conferences. And the extent to which statements about genetics and the genome can be regulated depends on which of those contexts the person's in.
So does it help to think of data as a product, or is that in fact a dangerous way of starting to analyze this?
I personally think it's very dangerous, and one of the concerns, as you no doubt are aware, FDA earlier this year has been putting out draft guidances, which are still under discussion, proposing to have a more extensive presence in regulating laboratory-developed tests, which that's a category of tests that include a lot of genetic and genomic tests. And one concern about having FDA regulate these things is that a genetic test isn't just a product. There's a product that is the machine that does the test, but a lot of it is interpretation services. What do your readings mean? And as the genetic testing industry is evolving, those aren't always done by the same entity. One entity may run your test and another may interpret it. And the safety critical part is the interpretation. And a concern if FDA regulates that whole pipeline of services as a product, it could put interpretation under strict product liability, so that if you just are wrong in a diagnosis and through no negligence, it would be strict liability. So there are a lot of very serious implications in treating information as a product.
Yeah, fascinating. So, Eric, you are a major force, and not to spare your blushes too much, a force for good in the ELSI research program during the original genome mapping project and so on. And most of our listeners will know about GINA, the Genetic Non-Discrimination Statute, which came out around that time and was influenced, obviously, by some of that work. And Barbara and I, from our work, know that the High-Tech Act and then the Omnibus Rule have sort of moved things along somewhat. So I guess a couple of questions. Did ELSI and its work solve all the ethical and legal problems and social problems associated with genetics and genetic research? And looking forward now to sort of heightened issues being raised by developments in epigenetics, the NIH Big Data Initiative, and of course the President's Precision Medicine Initiative, do you see a whole slew of new issues that are going to face us?
The answer to your first question about whether we've finished and solved the problems is clearly no, but it's not as obviously a no as you might think. When the Genome Project started, the idea behind the Ethical, Legal, and Social Implications Program was to anticipate and address the ethical issues. That was the motto, the watchword, begun when James Watson started it and Francis Collins continued the program. And my sense, having spent a couple of years in that program, was that we were exceptionally good at the anticipation. We were exceptionally good at the anticipation part of that equation. We funded many excellent scholars to identify the moral legal problems, to capture them empirically, and to try and, forgive me, to map the ethical issues at the same time that we were mapping the location of the genes. And if you sort of continue the metaphor, we did a pretty good job of sequencing the ethical, legal, and social issues, unpacking them, figuring out what the constitutive parts were, in much the same way that we tried to figure out what the order of the letters of the genetic alphabet were. And when the Genome Project was, quote, mapped and sequenced, largely by an agreement, not by a specific date or time, some would have said that we're done. Not only is the Genome Project finished, but so too are all the ethical issues, much like that infamous and apocryphal story of someone saying in the early 1900s that everything's been discovered, so we don't need a patent and trademark office anymore. I think that would have been naive then, and it is naive with ELSI issues, largely because just in the same way that genetic information is being used in new and unexpected ways, some of the more interesting, if not terribly sensational, ethical issues are at that same level too. How are we going to have conversations with patients about risk? A topic that has bedeviled philosophers and biostatisticians and psychologists for years. Some people are very innumerate. They cannot manipulate or let alone understand numbers. So to tell someone that they have a risk of 1 in 5,000 or their genetics confer a certain amount of risk raises phenomenal challenges. It's not a sexy topic like embryonic stem cell research and the moral status of a small ball of cells, but in some ways it's even more profound because you have now an industrialization process going on in taking information and trying to apply it. So you don't even have to go as far as the Precision Medicine Initiative or big data. We were going to be addressing those ethical issues for as long as there were patients, information, and clinicians. I'm not limiting this to physicians. We don't have enough nurses. We don't have enough genetic counselors. We don't have enough social workers. So this has become more than just a medical ethics issue. It's also a societal issue. It's a labor issue. It's an economic issue. So we've got plenty of work to do over the next 10 or 20 years.
So I think one of the questions is, who's going to do that work? When I talk to you individually or when we're together, I think a thread that runs through your work is that a sense you give that we're still sort of structurally, organizationally, agency-wise, living in sort of the mid-20th century, and yet the issues that we need to deal with may need a fundamental retooling. And it's easy to just say we need a fundamental retooling, but if you agree with that, what process do we try and follow to get there, and with what sort of substantive end, Barbara?
One of the things that distinguishes the challenge today is that the things we scientifically don't know may require different modes of study than the ones that paid out so handsomely in the 20th century. In the 20th century, there were some workhorses of how we learn things. One was the randomized controlled clinical trial, which is still very important. But it's really a small sample. You take 600 to 3,000 people that are a little sample of humanity and study them. The challenge we have now is that a lot of things that we don't know, such as what is the clinical significance of most of the human genome, you know, what does it imply about health, require really massive methods of study that require inclusive data sets that include hundreds of millions of people. This means that our 20th century bioethics sort of framed autonomy as this individual characteristic. It's what people did by themselves, and it was the individual against the healthcare system. That set up people as sort of fundamentally alone, and the scientific challenges we have now take collective action. We as a society need to decide we're going to figure out how the human genome affects health. And to do that, we're going to need data sets of 300 to 500 million people. And we have to come together as a society and decide, do we want that knowledge? Is it worth the inconvenience, the privacy risks? And if so, how do we make a collective decision to do it? And in a way, 20th century bioethics disempowered us by making us each an individual agent and not creating a framework of governance where we can make collective decisions together.
Right. So
and that's what we need to do now.
I have a sense that neither autonomy nor consent scale very well.
Well, it just is a different concept of autonomy, I think. I think in the 1960s, a lot of the foundational works saw autonomy as an individual characteristic, but there's a part of our autonomy that's realized in collaboration with other people. You know, if you have an autonomous characteristic that's realized by flying airplanes, you need a ground controller and a plane man. You need a lot of people other than yourself to achieve your autonomy. And that's what our bioethics hasn't taken into account. It's a herd characteristic. We get our autonomy by interacting with each other.
So we've had some surrogates for the broader societal needs and so on, right? I mean, that's, I think at least is one of the function of the IRB or some of the other kind of institutions that we have. But have they sort of reached the end of the line?
I want to come back to the first question. I think Barbara, in being provocative, was nailing a very important issue that I don't think people are always prepared to accept. And that's, your question was, how do we study these issues? And while it's true that the early history of bioethics had a kind of segmented approach to it, there were philosophers working on projects and the like. I think the spirit of collaboration was there from the start. It was a lack of methodologic interdisciplinarity that often got in the way of these issues. So to be fair, not that that's required, but to be fair, an awful lot of the work that I think Barbara's alluding to and maybe behind your question, Nick, was done quietly by our colleagues in public health. And our colleagues in public health have been thinking about pulling their hair out for years. They didn't need genetic testing to have these debates, whether it was about vaccination or whether it was about fluoridating water. These debates about how do we make decisions as a society on behalf of the collective or on behalf of society as a group, the methods available to us were limited to voting. So you could vote for a representative and hoped like heck that they knew something about science and weren't ascientific. You could perhaps volunteer to be a member of a committee that might make decisions. Your reference to IRBs, I think, is tangential only in the sense of it was a democratic or attempt to be a democratic institution to help make decisions about ethics. But quite frankly, we all know that despite there being 4,000 IRBs in the country, they are still institutional entities created by institutions as a requirement of federal regulation. If you're going to carry out research with federal funds, you must have a committee. Not may, not should. This isn't an ethics advisory board. It's a requirement. So I think there's a bunch of things going on, and I just think that we're at a very nice inflection point in science policy, because really what we're talking about is the confluence of public health policy, science policy, and probably several other things, trade policy, economic policy, to participate in these discussions. Neil Lane, Bill Clinton's former science advisor, wrote a lovely piece that said we need new ways of thinking about these issues, not just the same people in the same room. We need to be talking to social scientists and economists and lawyers. A good colleague and friend of all of ours, I think, Jim Childers from the University of Virginia, once famously said that bioethics is too important to be left to the bioethicists, whoever those people might be. So I think there's plenty of room for the kind of creativity that Barbara's talking about.
The existing regulations we have, and the ones that are important in research with data, tend to be the common rule, which Eric mentioned, that governs research funded by federal agencies, and then the HIPAA privacy rule, which governs flows of data in healthcare settings. both those regulations have important mechanisms for making collective decisions to use people's data without their consent in contexts where you need an inclusive data set that wouldn't have the bias of selection bias where only the consenters are included. Those have been very controversial, obviously, but the way it works is that an institutional review board or privacy board is able to make a decision to allow data to be used. The difficulty with that scheme is that institutional review boards are mostly staffed by people who work for the institution that wants to either give the data or use it. So there's a little bit of a conflict there. And then another potential conflict is that I think most IRBs are staffed by sincere people who are trying to protect the people whose data are being held. And that they sort of feel a fiduciary duty informally to those people. And yet when they're making collective decisions about data use, they're really representing the public's interest. And I think that role doesn't come comfortably for them. I think one of the solutions here is that a lot of really good data are now being generated outside the context of HIPAA privacy rule and the common rule, things like wearable fitness devices. They're generating bodies of data that are, for the most part, outside those regulations. And you have communities of active, you know, people who are interested in tracking their own data and often interested in learning from it. And because they're not under the regulations, they're innovating and trying to think of ways to move their data for public good. And I think they may be an experimental laboratory that comes up with some self-governance mechanisms. Why don't we let the people whose data are in a data set decide how it will be used? We haven't ever trusted the people. We thought they wouldn't let it be used. I think if we would let people make collective decisions about using their data, we might be very pleasantly surprised how good the decisions would be. We should try it.
Although we're certainly not there yet, because the kinds of technological models I think you probably have in mind are things like Apple's research kit running on the iPhone software and stuff like that, that researchers are able to build these really fascinating large-scale trials on. Yet when you look at it, the regulation is actually provided by App Store rules as to what you have to do, one of which is you have to have an IRB. So I wonder whether, in fact, we're crushing this new space and this is, I'm amazed that I'm actually saying this, because I've been so critical of the HIPAA-free zone and what it means, but whether we're actually crushing this sort of innovative space before people do get a chance to really sort of speak collectively.
Well, one interesting development happened late in 2014 in October when the HIPAA privacy rule was amended to allow individuals to have access to their data that are held by clinical laboratories. That's a new regulation, and I understand people are having difficulty exercising that right, but in principle, it allows an individual person to ask, please give me my data, and people can get their data and form communities to use it. And that's a very interesting development, because it gets the data outside of the control of the data holders. And potentially you can form communities for citizen research where people are getting their data, getting together, hiring some scientists, and deciding what to do with it.
But meanwhile, in a relatively unregulated space filled with fairly avaricious commercial data brokers, mm-hmm. all of that data is being sucked up for commercial uses. And that's the sort of the problem I have with that space.
Survey data show people have an aversion to having their data used by commercial entities. But commercial research is actually usually more translational and more close to developing products that benefit people than the more upstream, pure academic research. And maybe part of this evolving we're going through is that we need to get a more adult relationship toward money, that just because someone profits from research doesn't mean the research doesn't serve the public good.
Yeah, I think it's an excellent point, and not only because I agree with it, I think it's an excellent point. Anyway, a couple things, Nick, that this back and forth reminds me of. This is not the first time in this country or in this world of research that we've had discussions about patients or the community taking responsibility for research. It happened in the early 1980s when the first HIV trials for antiretrovirals were started, where the community itself was not only dissatisfied but outraged with the design of clinical trials, and we saw groups like ACT UP and others start to take on responsibility for. Same thing happened with breast cancer, and it's happened in other, principally the rare disease community, where there aren't a lot of studies going on for their particular disease, so they have taken it upon themselves. So point one is, it's not unusual for the concept of the public or citizen science, as it's now being called, to sort of re-emerge under the guise of the data stream that is passing by their front door. Best that they step into it intentionally than for them to be overtaken by a tsunami. The second model that doesn't usually get discussed, and since this is a podcast, I would be interested in what your followers think about this, and that's the model of crowdsourcing in science and in fundraising. This democratization of public engagement is only now starting, and I don't even know where it's going to go. So in the ELSI speak of anticipate and address, I'm not even sure I can anticipate where it's going, let alone address it. But it's not going to stop. So we see X prizes for various topics. We see citizens far more engaged. That said, look at the outcry when it was revealed that Facebook had altered or manipulated different settings in what was called a very large experiment without consent. Was it consent because you agree to be on Facebook? And of course, we could debate those things. But this is not something that the Common Rule or any of the federal regulators sitting around the table in 1978 to 1981 anticipated, even when they referred to de-identified data. Because even that is so last century, de-identified data. We now know we can re-identify de-identified data. And even if that wasn't a big deal, many people don't care about their data being made available. What they do care about is who's going to use it and for what purpose.
One of the problems I think people are more aware of is that individuals often want to consent to have their data used for publicly beneficial purposes. And unfortunately, the fact that one consents isn't always sufficient to make sure it will be used, because as you just mentioned, quite often one's data are held by a data holder, a hospital, a commercial entity that holds the data. And if you consent and the data holder doesn't want to let the data go, you don't get to participate in research. And that problem has been so understudied in bioethics. Bioethics has been really concerned about situations where the individual doesn't consent and the data get used anyway, and been almost completely pitiless of the poor individual who wants to participate and is being thwarted by a data holder. And that's why I think we need access forcing provisions like the one I mentioned in HIPAA, where individuals can get their data and then do with it as they wish. The Common Rule has no access forcing mechanism. It's completely lopsided in that matter.
I also think we have the technology to solve some of these issues. I mean, that's what metadata is for, right? You attach the consent and the type of consent to the data. And as that moves through the system, different users are given, on the basis of that metadata, different access.
One other thing, not that this is a defense of bioethics, because I'm not sure what the term now means. It's so multifaceted. But just the term consent itself is probably an obsolete idea. We now have many different kinds of consent: dynamic, implied, broad, informed, substituted. There are different models for different situations. Some were anticipated back in the day. children who can't consent. We have a logical model for how that occurs. We haven't updated as much as I think we all might wish that we had these consent models for contemporary use in areas like data management. Just as Barbara was describing the clinical trial as really the gold standard for regulatory matters, it was also the gold standard for ethics and review matters. The idea was giving you enough information about the possible physical harms to your body from participating in this study that you should know enough in order to accept those risks or to decline them. Very hard to describe what the risks are in terms that are meaningful about data breach, data misuse. And look, we know that there have been lots of data breaches in areas outside of healthcare. So it's a fascinating opportunity to sort of compare and contrast.
I think also an awful lot of our approaches, consent, de-identified as opposed to identified, are incredibly bimodal. Everything's an on-off switch. Mm-hmm. There's very little nuance.
I think the forcefulness of the consent norm in research traces to the fact that much of our bioethics and regulatory framework was modeled on an interventional clinical trial where the researchers are actually touching the body and doing things with it. And that has a long history dating back centuries in common law, that an unconsented touching is a battery and a crime and a tort. We moved from an era of interventional physical research to this information age and sort of borrowed the norms from that. And it's not clear that the same consent norms apply. Your data are not who you are. The philosopher Charles Taylor has sort of bemoaned the impoverished ontological accounts of human being, of who are we. And in this modern time, I think there's a confusion. Your data set is not the essence of your being. And when we demand such a strong consent norm as if our very personhood is being invaded, I think that sort of lends some weight to Taylor's concern that we're confused. You know, your data are not yourself.
So in the last couple of minutes that we have together, as two researchers and teachers that I admire a lot, let's assume that tomorrow in your respective offices, Eric, a fully funded prospective PhD student, Barbara, in your office, a fully funded prospective SJD candidate, they walked in the door and asked you what would be a good use of their research energy for the next few years. Where would you send them, Eric?
I can't say plastics, can I?
No.
Like from the movie The Graduate. I'm not going to punt, but I will qualify my answer by saying the fully funded PhD student might actually come from several different, or come in through several different portals. They may be doing bioethics through a public health degree, in which case I would urge them, encourage them, plead with them, beg them to focus their attention on literacy of the public and understanding the critical role of economics and ethics in public health promotion and disease prevention. If, on the other hand, they were walking in through a different door, perhaps a real philosophy or applied ethics door, I would ask them to undertake more research in areas that don't include those traditional concepts of consent and privacy. I think in some ways we've done those to death. We've fully mapped and sequenced the genomes of informed consent and privacy. In fact, I had a graduate student who counted the number of papers, and they're well over 50,000 in each of these areas. So I'd ask them to focus on issues of collectivity and the social contract, and how do we think about organizing ourselves. I have several other student ideas, but those are two just to give you an example of it depends on which door they're walking into. I'd love if I could have two students, all the better.
One of the big challenges, if humanity is going to unlock these unsolved problems, is that we need massive investments in infrastructure, things like information systems, privacy protection mechanisms. I think the scope of the problems we have is beyond what even well-funded government agencies like NIH can fund, and we need to find out appropriate mechanisms for sustainable financing of research, public-private partnerships. How do we mobilize private capital in ways that still serve the public good? I think there's a lifetime of work in making the future research enterprise financially sustainable.
I just hope you don't mean Facebook and Google. And that was this week's The Week in Health Law. A very, very special thank you to Eric Meslin.
Pleasure to be here, Nick. Thanks.
Eric, you're on Twitter, aren't you?
I am, at E.M. Meslin.
And Barbara, thank you so much for being on. I think you're smart enough not to be on Twitter.
Thank you for having us. Bye-bye.
We post our show notes at twill.com. That's twill.com. Also, thanks to IU McKinney's own Dave Plouffe for his technical wizardry helping us put this episode together. Remember that at twill.com you'll see a link to our crowdfunding page if you'd like to support the show. And, of course, you can contact me at Nicholas Terry on Twitter. Thank you for joining us, and have a legally interesting but healthy week.